There are issues that deal with the world and the future of the world, our world, the universe perhaps, that seem at the moment to be unanswerable and yet are simply inescapable. And you can all think of them. We read about the greenhouse effect, and we all thought about population pressures and so forth. And in struggling with the title for tonight's forum, it seemed to me the best thing to say was reactions to those unanswerable but inescapable problems. How do you react? What, if anything, do you do? It ranges all the way from freezing in sheer panic to sitting down and writing a report called the Global Report, the year 2000, addressed to the President of the United States at his request, which Barney did, which he's discussed with us during the week. One of the things that's always amazed me about Holden is how in a week you can have talent pouring out from every bush all over the place, and we are very fortunate in having a panel tonight uniquely qualified to discuss this issue. My far right, Connie Nuttall, is interested in ecology. She lectures on that subject at the University of Iowa School of Medicine. She is the author of a couple books on that subject and is continuing to work in that field. Most of you by this time have probably heard Jerry Barney conducting some sessions and helping us think about that. He's going to continue that during the next week. Jerry is, by training, a physicist. More recently, he's been doing research projects, directing them, on the question of the Earth's future and everything associated with it. Most of you know Rudy Edmonds, been around Holden ever since there's been a Holden, I think. A geologist by original training, once upon a time with Standard of Ohio, as its CO, as I remember. More recently, he's been teaching geology at Thousand Oaks. He's a man who knows so much about this valley, the mine. He's probably forgotten more than most of us will ever know about it. Besides that, he's a good fisherman. On my far left, Glenn Mogelson. Mogelson, am I saying that correctly? It took Glenn a long time to teach me to say that. If it'd been a decent German name, I could have handled it. Glenn is a physicist also. He's currently at the National Laboratory at Los Alamos, New Mexico, where he works with a lot of other people on extraordinarily significant problems dealing with our future and the future of the world. I think the best way to approach this topic is to do as we usually do in forums, and that is to ask each of our panelists to give us a short statement about the subject, a thing or two that they would like for us to think about, and then with that kind of background, let us, the rest of us here, start expressing our own concerns and feelings and reactions and questions, see how each other feels, and to the extent that it proves helpful, perhaps to have dialogue between you folks, among you folks, and with the panel as you wish. There is no speaking order for this tonight, except that I have asked Glenn, and I should say that both Glenn and Connie are guests in the village this week, and they've been kind enough when I jumped on them and said, look, you've got to join this panel, to say yes. So I've asked Glenn whether he would start out from his perspective, and then you can go as you like from there on out. Glenn?
Now I have to say from the start that my mind at this point feels very heavy. I guess because so many questions, unanswerable questions, have come back into my mind this week that it makes my mind, my head, very heavy. I can't talk about all of those, so there's just a couple that I'll mention. One of them is related to my own work. I'm involved in energy research, fusion energy research. And one of the reasons I'm involved in that area is a concern for energy, future energy. I do not believe that oil or coal, two of the major sources of energy that we have right now, will be around very much longer. My hope is that we will be able to use curium, which is much more plentiful, for our future generations. It will be a very long-term process of developing that energy source. But if our children's 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 children, that is measured in 300 years, 400 years, are going to have energy, we need to develop something like fusion and solar and sources that are plentiful that we're not developing now. And so I'm involved in that field, and I would hope that people here who have questions about nuclear energy and are worried about it really pursue it in depth. The other area is completely different. The question came to mind as a result of reading articles recently on genetics. The question is, what does it mean to have a defect as a human? What is normal? If you are able to genetically create or destroy defects before they become, before the person occurs, what does that mean? What does it mean in society to be the same? That looks like another area that maybe not in our time, at least looking at the people here, but certainly in our children's time will be one of the questions that you're going to have to deal with.
Thank you.
Maybe I can pick up there, because one point I was going to raise directly follows from what Glenn just said, and that's that I think Jerry's done a good job of addressing a number of important topics this week, and we could all add topics that we thought were equally important but related. But two that I wanted to add were things that relate to the genetic character of the world, and the first one is the question of recombinant DNA research. And I don't know how many people are familiar with that or understand genetic research at all, but the idea is simply that now we have the power to take genes from one species and put them into another species and as a result combine species. And as Glenn was saying, potentially in the near future, I don't think it's that far, do genetic engineering on fetuses before they're born, so that, for example, the tendency to develop diabetes at a certain age would be removed. That type of thing, I think, is what Glenn is talking about. And there was discussion in the Congress earlier this year about whether we should fund in this country a crash program for mapping the entire human genome, taking every gene in the human body and mapping every chromosome and mapping on that chromosome what few molecules control what trait. As I understood it, the assumption is that this knowledge will be available in the near future, 20, 30 years. That's inevitable. We already know what loci on chromosomes determine certain traits in humans. And the question was simply, how fast should we develop this knowledge? Should we put a crash program, should we fund a crash program in the microbiology labs so that we have all the chromosomes mapped within the next 10, 15 years? In my mind, that question is similar to, my husband criticizes me for this, but he's not here, so I'll say it anyway, to the question about having a crash program to develop the nuclear bomb. Here's knowledge that maybe we shouldn't have. Maybe this is another bite, as Jerry was saying tonight, another bite out of the apple of good and evil. And once we have this knowledge, it would lead to the ability to do intensive genetic engineering. It's justified with the idea that we would be able to eliminate human suffering because we would be able to eliminate inherited defects. But it could be misused, and perhaps we should never know that. The second thing that I wanted to throw out was what I see as a counterpart for what Jerry was discussing this week. And he was talking about how we as one species are altering the planet and how that will impact on us as one species. And what I deal with professionally is what's happening to all of the other species out there. And this is something I've dealt with for many years, trying to kind of mesh my professional interests and my passions in life with my religious beliefs. In my viewpoint, the beauty of creation that God has given us has been the genetic diversity and of the planet. And that genetic diversity is housed within the 8 to 10 million species that exist in this world. And now we're viewing and seeing unprecedented rates of extinction of species, and more species are becoming extinct faster and faster. And I guess to me this is a real moral question. How as Christians, if we say we value creation and we see God in all creation, as we said in the service tonight, how can we take part in this extinction, which is what we're doing now through our acts of omission, if not acts of commission? And secondly, you can argue against this, of course, from a practical point of view. Very simplistically stated, the simpler the ecosystem, the more likely it is to undergo dramatic fluctuations, so that as we simplify our ecosystems, they become less stable, and we become the victims of that decrease in stability. And to tie it into the other depressing themes of the week, ecologists have likened this loss of diversity, the potential effects of the loss of genetic diversity have been likened to the effects of nuclear holocaust, and this is something that ecologists assume now, and they make this comparison standardly. So those are the things that I'm interested in. I should say there are real efforts now to preserve genetic diversity, and if anyone is interested in those, I could talk about those efforts.
Well, I guess Jerry has had some words with us this evening, so maybe I could kind of be the generalist here. And I think one of my major concerns is education and how we as a species are really going to learn what the impact of the things we do are going to bear down on us in the future. Because looking at it as a student of the earth, I am a geologist. I have been very much interested and taught paleontology, which is a study of the life of the past. And I'm very much aware that we've had many extinctions during the past of specific species. And I think there is a sense in which we as a species are extremely vulnerable in the environment as it exists today. Our knowledge has propelled us into a position that we can do things now that can very materially affect the environment and affect our ability to cope with it. And that's what concerns me, because we can do things now that impact really the entire Earth and the universe in a sense. So we have created the power with the knowledge and the brain power that we're given in creation, and I think that it's too important from the long-range point of view to think that scientists can correct and govern these things. It's the species as a whole, all of the people. We're one family, and wherever we are in the world, we are affected by what goes on with what we are able to do to the atmosphere, to the oceans, to all parts of the earth. And I think we really do not understand what we're heading into in the long range. Things seem to be very important short range, but to look at thousands and millions of years ahead, it becomes quite a different perspective. And that's the kind of thing that concerns me, and I think it's too important to think that the schools and the scientists are going to be able to solve this. It's a problem for the church, it's a problem at home, and the creation of an attitude and an environment of trying to make the best decisions that we can about our very own environment. God placed us in the garden. The earth is our garden. And we are one species. And the earth will continue whether we are here or not. And we don't have to worry about the earth. We can see that through time, one species or another, but if we're concerned about our own species, then we have a problem of how do we deal with it from an educational point of view.
Thank you, Rudy.
I'll give just a very quick summary of the things that I've been trying to talk about. In the future, or the shaping of the future of the planet, I think that there are two broad kinds of concepts that have shaped the direction in which human society has been going for a long time. And one of those is the idea of development. The notion has been for a long time that there is not any fundamental injustice in the world when a very populous nation has a very low per capita income. The idea is that each nation can grow and get an economy as big as it wants. What has emerged from a wide range of studies over the past decade is the idea that that's no longer true. That the impact on the environment, the impact on the resources of indefinite growth in population and economic activity, agricultural activity, is such that the life support systems of the planet simply cannot take indefinite expansion. and that sometime, if present growth trends would continue, sometime along about the middle of the next century, we would experience a catastrophic decline in population from one of a variety of causes. This means that attention is going to have to be given to some alteration in our concept of development, and some question to, or some attention to the question of justice and distribution of income and wealth among nations, among peoples. That has not yet occurred, and I think there will be a good deal of resistance to doing it. So one major problem is that our concept of development, our concept of equity and justice among nations, has been based on a false premise, and that is that growth in population and economic activity can go on indefinitely increasing. Now, another major premise that we have operated with is that security, national security, can be based on violence or the threat of violence. And that, of course, the people who are called upon to execute that violence, the military forces, want to have on their side the most powerful weapons available. This has led to a steady increase in the amount of violence that can be done by individual weapons and by weapons collectively. And we've now reached the point where the weapons available in the arsenals of the world could be used in such a way that in all probability it would so severely damage the life support system of the planet that it would lead to the extinction of the human species. These two major concepts, paradigms, if you will, of the guidance and management of the planet will shape the future of the Earth in a profound way. And I think that they are going to have to, well, they must be rethought in some very fundamental dimensions. And I think they're connected in that the poorest of the poor people of the world are experiencing violence. They are experiencing violence in the form of hunger and malnutrition, infant mortality, and many other ways. And there's, I think, for some understandable reason, a lot of hostility there. But we're moving in a way in which the destructive potential that's available to small groups or even individuals is such that the world simply cannot afford to have even one person who has no stake in the future, because that person can do enormous damage if not destroy the whole planet itself. So the injustice that has prevailed in the sense of economic development and opportunity is now coupled into the security area, in that through terrorist action, as we would call it, some extreme violence can take place. And the two major theories for guiding the future of the planet are really now under in need of severe revision. And I personally hope that Christians and the church can play a significant role in helping to reformulate and provide a viable notion and plan or vision for the future of the planet. To do that, however, is going to require some major rethinking on the part of the church itself. And that's the part that I want to try to talk about some next week. So that's in brief what I've been talking about.
So we have four excellent places to start here. Since you heard them, I'll not try to recapitulate them, if I may borrow Dan's word. But I do want to make two comments. One is that Jerry, just finishing spoke of justice and equity and the need to protect against the acts of people when they resort to violence. I think that's very understandable. I chose my own career as a lawyer and as a law professor later because of a chance comment that was made by a Lieutenant White, a man that I spent a lot of time with in the Far East where we both were in the military, who after one especially bad exchange with the enemy was approached by a person with a microphone, and the person said, Lieutenant, give me your reactions to the carnage that you have just witnessed. And Lieutenant White, who was a lawyer, said, I think this real estate question ought to be settled in the courts. And I suppose that he had a lot of influence in my own choice of profession, because somehow or other we've got to learn what justice and equity mean and how humanity might do it. The other comment I want to make is Rudy's search is a good scientist for a unified theory that will put together all of the pieces of information that come from the ecologists and the geologists and the physicists and everyone else who tends to approach these problems. Someone once did a nasty study by which they set up a person with a problem and then sent that person out to a number of different professional people to recite the problem. And not surprisingly, each professional listened to the problem and then offered a solution based upon that professional's skills and training. What else can you do? Rudy suggested, as you recall, that maybe we've got to broaden our discussion tonight a little bit and recognize that there is here, blame the moderator of the forum for not having a fifth person up here, a theologian, to help us address the problems that both Rudy and Jerry just kicked out. Fortunately, we have three sitting back there, maybe more over here, I don't know. But Elmer and Mike and Dan are there, and I'm sure we can call on them if we get stuck. So, reactions to these problems, whether they are products of a world which is going through changes, products of things that are happening, like the greenhouse effect, because of our striving to live the way we live, whether they are a product of the threat that we will do ourselves in unless we learn how to do it better. Reactions. Sir.
Well, one thing I found myself feeling is a tremendous amount of excitement about these discussions. I got really down at the first part of your presentation this evening and, you know, reacted with you afterwards about it. And my background is 21, 22 years now as a psychotherapist. And the process of how people change at a very basic level is what I work with every day. And what occurs to me, my background before that was as a science teacher. And what occurs to me is that the information that is coming in is the new frontier. We've always pushed west. We're up against the ocean. We can't go any further that way, and the world has become too small. With the information and space, it seems to be the new frontiers. And if we're not going to fight one another, if we're really going to find ways to solve problems, it's going to be because we have challenges that somehow excite us. And I find myself getting excited with the impossibility of those situations we've been talking about, but realizing that what can help people stop fighting each other is when they get deeply involved and invested in something that they care about. And the process of doing that is like when you come up against the impossibility of annihilation or the impossibility of some of the questions that we're raising here. What will happen if we have not any more fossil fuels and we don't discover how to harness others? Those things are going to challenge, is my belief. Those things are going to challenge us as mankind, as human beings, to use our computers in creative ways to begin to solve problems. None of us is going to understand any single piece of this well enough. We're going to become such specialists And then the question would be, can we learn to talk to each other about what we're studying? But to me, that's how we're going to solve it.
Stimulated by crisis, huh?
Stimulated by a crisis, and also by the fact that there's hope. To me, as I was saying to you, I think that the reality is that, and Dan was saying this, the intervention of Christ into the world is not just a human personal event, but it's a world-changing event.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a question, just a comment. How globally aware are people beyond the scientific community, and you know, how prevalent is the awareness of the statistics as to where we're at in terms of the problem? Do so many Americans have a Steven Spielberg mentality that this is, we've heard all this, it's all going to blow up something, and we're immune to it, or we're numb to the idea, and it's going to scare us kind of routine. How do you see the awareness factor of all this taking place? Are people responding to it beyond just the scientific community, or is it globally? Are people, are the leadership aware of that and they're just ignoring it? Or?
I suppose Jerry has studied that more than anyone else. You want to respond?
Well, there's a lot of denial that goes on. People don't want to really face up to what's there. I think there are large numbers of people who know many of the facts. But putting them all together and recognizing the significance of them all is, there are not many who do that. And I'd say in the United States, particularly in the last 8 years, there's been less attention to the kind of synthesis of all of this. Outside the United States, there's, I'd say, probably been a continued growth in awareness, particularly in the developing countries. I think, for the most part, most developing countries no longer look at the United States as a model for their development. They're looking at places like China, and we heard yesterday Nicaragua as being a model that many people are looking at. Cuba continues to be a model. Japan, to some extent, is, but even Japan is not regarded as a viable model for many countries. So people are changing their views on the outside of the United States. But it's important that we kind of get our heads together too and understand what the situation is.
You don't see it as a campaign issue, in other words, as home?
I don't. I really don't, because I don't think either of the candidates is prepared mentally to really address this, nor do I think the electorate is going to be looking for it. I think that's just not going to happen.
Bob?
I'd like to address an issue which I, frankly, have been a little disappointed. I haven't heard it only tangentially in many of the discussions this week, namely that a lot of the problems, particularly the arms race, which we've heard so much about in the several kinds of discussions and how it affects the world, is really a product of nationalism. Clearly, if there were not national boundaries, people wouldn't have separate armies and separate armaments to protect each other. And more specifically, I'd like to address, since we're here at Holden, the relationship between nationalism and religion. Religious institutions generally have, in their own countries, been strongly nationalistic. And we can think of, listening on the late night radio, of many pastors who push nationalism as a religion, really. I mean, that's what it amounts to, and this is often the case. And clearly, that doesn't happen here. But I think we've only addressed that tangentially. It's a sensitive issue. And let me offer a thesis. It's my view that that it's a moral imperative at this point that religious institutions should encourage the view that the kind of nationalism which builds up these national defenses, I'm not talking about cultural diversity, which I think is a good thing, but the sort of militaristic buildup inside of borders is no longer something which is viable in a nuclear world. And needs and religious institutions, since they are supposed to be guiding the moral and ethical view of their members, ought to be aggressively pursuing an evolution of that idea. And I don't see that happening. In fact, in some sense, I probably see the opposite happening. And that hasn't been discussed here. It seems to me that's something that I'm not sure this is the kind of forum that we could think about ways in which we could address that. It's a difficult subject, but it seems to be at the heart of many of the issues we've talked about.
Palmer? Just that it has been discussed in weeks before. Dan's 5 presentations on the church in the other countries was essentially an effort to get at a global understanding of humanity. And our little ways have seen to it that there are flags from all the nations here, and our flag day is always an international flag day. We refuse to have an American flag day. It's our minor efforts to do it, but it's been recurring theme, not a focus of a week.
The sheer terror of the sort of thing that Bob was talking about, perhaps you'll forgive a personal reference, can be illustrated by something that I saw once. 1971, the Amnesty International and the Lutheran World Federation sent me to Namibia to represent a black person who was on trial then. And in order to do that, I had to stop in South Africa and get my visa stamped so I could go to... I thought I would go to see some clerk. I was, to my great surprise, I wound up with the equivalent of our Secretary of State. The trial was one of some significance, but I didn't expect that kind of treatment. I recognized his name because he was the son of a well-known Lutheran pastor. And Namibia is, of course, largely Lutheran, as you know. Well, I guess you know. Anyway, before long, our conversation drifted off into the theology of this matter. And I told him that I thought that the faith that we shared demanded freedom for these people from the kind of oppression they were experiencing. He assured me that was not the case, that it was his duty as the person that God had put in position to care for these people, care for them as children, inasmuch as they were incapable of caring for themselves. It seemed to me it'd be an outrageous position to take, and I said as much. And then he said, Professor Rieke, each morning, 1 hour before this office opens, I am here on my knees. And I spend that hour in prayer, hoping that God will be able to sustain me in what I must do to prevent these people from being harmed by people like you from the rest of the world. And do you question my Christianity? Now, what can you say? Yes?
Of course.
It's the point that Bob makes to me when he talks about it is the completely untractable position that you get into when you freeze into a theological position that makes all rational approach to a problem end. And I think I agree that we've got to tackle that problem. That's too long for moderator. I'm supposed to occupy a position, not space. Sir?
I think Jerry and I talked about this a little bit. I mean, that opens up many questions. One of them being, is there something about our government that needs to be changed? And how do we go about doing that? How do we go about thinking about it? One of the visions that I've had is that you think of, in your experience, what are the little things that might be occurring that could break down the nationalism process, or whatever, however you describe it. And I guess I'm a very hopeful person, and one of the things that I see as as breaking it down is the travel of people throughout the world. But even more than that, the development of our communication so that, as I was mentioning to Jerry, I can sit down at Los Alamos and talk to somebody in Spain, Germany, Japan, almost anywhere in Europe, and some places in South America. That continue, and that we try to develop a vision. I think probably in parts, like I have a very strong vision of a united Europe, and sometime in the far future, a vision of a united Earth, and how we work to that. So I think it's possible, but maybe a long time.
I think that's quite interesting. As an American who has lived outside of the U.S. for quite a few years, I think that that's the thing I see about Americans. It really bothers me that they have not become global. And I think my children see that when they travel. And I saw a program one time, too, where a bunch of Russians were brought to Washington State to live with Americans, and they had also gone to Russia. And the thing that was so strong in that was the Americans were saying to these Russians, look how we live. It wasn't, we want to share who we are with you, is that we live the best way that's possible. And we want you to see that and take it back and become like that. And I think that is a thing that Americans are really awakening to now and are saying that America is a great place to live, but other places are great places to live too. And that we can share this existence here no matter who we are and what country we come from. That being American doesn't mean you but I was brought up with that idea too. Boy, if you're an American, you've got it all, and there was no other. But living outside of the U.S., I think, really brings that other people believe that their way of life is just as great as the way of life in the U.S. And I think that's one thing Americans really have to struggle with.
Interesting you should say that, because Glenn, I believe it was just yesterday or the day before, was telling me that he's struggling with how do you teach your children that they must live at a level of opulence less than we've been living in the United States or to share with the rest of the world. Other reactions out there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, tentatively thinking about taking the risk of being a little skeptical, more so than the people I hear here, about human nature. And amongst the Christian community as well. I hear wonderful ideals that, you know, warm my heart, but I know very few people in my daily life, and I live surrounded by generally good middle-class American people and kind of come into contact with many daily as a family physician, that aren't at base protecting themselves, aren't trying to hang on and survive, aren't trying to just get through the day, aren't trying to provide from week to week, paycheck to paycheck, what they need, who don't want to hear too much bad news, who will elect a Ronald Reagan who will give them good news, who will not respond to fear but will respond to hope. And what you were saying in terms of human change, if you offer negative goals, or if you offer fear, or if you offer limits, if you offer restraints, less opulence, less hope, a deterioration in people's eyesight or viewpoint about what they can expect, they won't listen to you. I think that this is a fact of human nature. Unless we've got a new evolved human, and maybe through the genetic engineering we can accomplish that. But, you know, and I bring that up tongue in cheek, but at the same time, what I'm getting at here is the crisis that seems to be needed. I don't know. I think there's a lot of good that can be done through these discussions and through social policy and political direction and through the movement and the letter writing. We can edge in these directions. I really don't have faith in what we're saying as going to be able to really change the world at the rate that it needs to be changed.
Yeah, but just think that there's too much inertia. I mean, this arms race is squandering so much human wealth.
I agree, and I think
so far you can sell that on precisely that point, that the wealth could be distributed in ways in which these people you're talking about could directly benefit. They're throwing their own tax dollars into this vast junk pile of arms.
And perhaps we are reaching a crisis with respect to that, and we have stepped away from it slightly in the past with Gorbachev and his offers and the slight build down that may be in sight. Perhaps that crisis has been recognized and stepped back from, or at least begun. But I'm wondering about other things. Here's a paradigm in my mind. Reading about NASA back at the time in which the project for the moon launch was conceived, there was a great deal of interest in putting a mechanized and unmanned flight on the moon. And it could have been done much more easily, cheaply, and probably with greater effect. Longer additional achievements could have occurred afterwards in unmanned flight. But the American public wouldn't buy it. It was something that needed to have the drama of the human involved. And I'm wondering if there's not going to, in terms of our conception for this planet, going to need to be some kind of a great, exciting thing that we can identify with as humans, in which there is some kind of transcendence that we need to build for the not the American, but for the global public. Not just saying our vision is of a Spartan existence and a reduced lifestyle. Simplicity and virtue must rule us all. We must all love one another as Jesus taught us to do. We've had 2,000 years and we've, I think, gone backwards in that regard. And I don't see real progress likely as we become more crowded. I see more people desiring to have theirs or hang on to it. So whether it's through genetic engineering and through miraculous transformations of the genetic environment, the human environment, or through space travel, something very, very dramatic and major seems to need to change, or else what we're talking about will be just glowing embers.
I think that all of these things can be tied together too, and an issue that I think people have to be aware of, and it's one that we try to put out of our minds, which is that as resources become scarcer, as population grows, and most of the population growth is in the third world countries, there tends to be a growing separatism among nations. I mean, the poor nations are getting poorer, the rich nations are getting richer, and so we're growing apart in that way, which means that the nations are less likely to come together and share resources. We're not going to annex a country that has, you know, mass starvation. It's just not going to happen. And I think that those trends, which relate to the growing environmental and resource depletion problems, again will build up the growth of nationalism. I mean, it'll emphasize nationalism rather than tending to decrease nationalism. That's something I think we have to tie those environmental problems into all of that.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to this too.
Would you like to respond?
No, we're getting near the
just
the end of the table.
In terms of listening to, I had to leave a little bit early for your talk tonight about problems. I personally think the nuclear arms race is sort of over in terms of being a major threat to the human species. That in the first few years when we had 5 bombs and they had 2, and Eisenhower had papers on his desk to waste them, to race the Russians with our deliverable arsenal. He rejected them, but now we have so many that shooting at each other is sort of unthinkable. You're going to end up shooting yourself in the foot. That the real problem coming is biological. That the physicists have delivered E=mc², and it turned out to be a hydrogen bomb, and we're learning to live with it. The geneticists are coming up with the ability to make basically everybody who's a human spare parts for everybody else. And right now, you know, we're talking about the social change that comes when you're walking down the street and you view your neighbor as spare parts with the right drugs, you can take his heart and make it. You thought your immune system think it's yours, and you know you have life for eternity. And there are and then the other thing is that we can't detonate the nuclear weapons and wipe out China and its drain on the Earth's resources without really damaging yourself in the foot again with the nuclear fallout and everything. But it's possible that you could create a virus or something that would do them in 5 or 10 days and then turn harmless. And so I think that in some respects, although we're looking towards the future, that nuclear weapons are the wrong thing to look at. We've been dealing with force and nationalism for 2,000, 5,000 years. I think there are other things that are much more subtle coming our way.
Take 45 seconds and respond to that.
Well, there are at least a couple of things to respond to. One, I know the point that you're making about the need for a positive image. And I think as one who works with people that you're trying to help change, you support the idea that a positive image is a lot easier to get people to turn to than one that's a matter of turning away from problems. The difficulty, the challenge that I feel in doing this is coming up with the positive image that I think is realistic. There are people who say, you know, we'll send people into space. Well, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't think that that's a really very viable proposition. There are others who say, you just got to have faith in the invisible hand that somehow when things get tough, there'll be an invention and it'll all be all right. Well, maybe. Maybe it will. But I perceive an awful lot of problems associated with some of the inventions that we already have, and I see an awful lot of things kind of closing in together, and I'm not sure where to point to say what the positive image is. I'm gradually developing a sense myself of what I think the positive image could be, but I really wish that somehow the church would take a role in this. The church keeps talking about what we're about is to redeem the creation. Well, what does that mean? You know, most of the professionals that I work with are not Christian, and they are actively hostile to the Christian people. And I take a lot of heat for continuing to be involved with the church. They say church is one of the most pernicious and pervasive sources of evil influence in the world that there is. And I ask them, well, why? I said, well, what does the church do? It's that it pretends that it has a solution, that it's out to redeem the world. And when you ask them, what do you want me to do? It is to join a church, sing in the choir, and usher. Yeah, and that's about the extent of the answer that you've got when you go to the average parish. I have tried to get the national church bodies of Lutheranism to put forward an image of what they think a redeemed planet would look like. They won't have anything to do with it. It scares them to death. And I think I know the reason. They haven't any idea what it would look like. They've never spent any time thinking about it. So, I have written an article, which I brought some copies of here, and if any of you are really interested in it, you can have copies of it. But there is an article here in which I've laid out what I perceive to be the problem and made an appeal to the church to come forward with some kind of image. Now, on this other matter, the other threat, the biological one, I agree. I think that's going to be a pretty serious one. I don't agree quite that the nuclear one is one to stop worrying about. But I fully agree that the biological one is going to be an enormous problem. You know, the reason that the National Academy of Sciences got so worried about genetic engineering is that high school students were being taught skills that would be necessary to take the E. coli out of the human intestine and modify it to the point where it would produce carcinogens. You know? You want everybody in the world to have that kind of knowledge? There's lots more that can be done, too. So, I agree.
I think we ought to put a tag on 3 or 4 minutes conditionally here and see whether or not Dan, Mike, Albert, you want to make any comment? It's just an invitation. Want to hold it till later, Rudy?
Well, maybe they'll respond with what I feel that the church too is very much has a great opportunity here that it is not moving into, and that is my concern. As I view it, as an earth scientist, I feel that we have moved so far from the environment in which we were placed originally, and we have moved out of the wilderness, and our technology has developed so far that we no longer appreciate the environment that we have to finally make peace with. And I think Joe Sittler, you know, in many ways has simply said that to treat the earth the way we do is just plain blasphemy. And you can't put it much stronger than that. And I really think that's where we are. And people don't want to face that. The church doesn't want to face it. And so we hide from the problem. And we are moving further and further out of the wilderness. If we just stop while you're at Holden and go the mile up the road and look at a place where there is no waste. There is no waste. Pollution is not a word that applies, and waste does not apply. And look at what our major problems are in all of the cities of the world. Garbage, waste disposal. Every city is challenged at this. And so we finally come to the point where we're trying to understand how we can survive. You know, as a species, how can we survive with all of this pollution? There's no species that fouls its nest like the human species. So what are we going to do about it?
I just wanted to respond to, something that I heard you saying indirectly, I think. And you can correct me. When you were talking, I felt that there's a sense of frustration with other people that you see as being caught up, and I think all of us feel this way, caught up in their own lives, unwilling to see beyond their nose in some sense. And I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people are in that situation, but I would suggest that everyone here have compassion on those people. Don't let that stop you in talking to people, giving them a vision of what you see. What you see is important. Don't feel that you're not capable of doing a great deal just by introducing the idea and continuing to do that, talking to people, discussing the things that you see, discussing what we've talked about here tonight. Everyone you see, if you have a chance, get the idea in their head. You don't know how that's going to proceed. They may not think about it for a while, but they may. It's there. It won't leave them. It will be in their subconscious. You can do a lot. That's how I want to respond to what you said.
More reactions?
I'll stick my neck out.
All right, sir.
It seems to me, and I'm not a good historian of the church or probably anybody else, that most of the time the answers to questions that are certainly not as profound as we see this one have not come from the institution. And when we say church, if we do mean the institution, it seems to me we're looking in the wrong place. I affirm the institution. It's a vehicle. It's fun to have around or whatever else you might want to say. But I don't think the answers will come there. I think for John Schramm's contention, for instance, that movements of some kind normally come from within the church, but external to it, to reshape the church in a way that will face the issues of the day. St. Francis is a classic example. And what did Martin have to do, dear brother, with all of his goodness and craziness? He had to go outside. The fight had to be. So the radicalness of being willing to love the church enough to go outside it and do things, and that's why Bolden, it's certainly not far outside the church, you know, but it doesn't. If it were a connected church, we probably wouldn't even be having this discussion, I think. I don't know.
I think you're right.
But there have to be radical enough people who say, we're going to do it. You know, the vision of the people who started this thing, I was looking up the pictures again today of those lovely people, Bernd Ricci among them, who had the vision that this place could be what it is today. That just amazes the daylights out of me. For me, it's a sign of hope. But I don't look for the structure to do it. You know, if you're looking for clergy to do it, you don't look to us. We're badly trained. Most of us do not have much an American theological education, much less a theological education that deals with issues that are global, you know. We haven't even learned how to deal with many of the issues of our own country yet. The hope for me comes from you people doing those very things that you're doing in these crazy places, suffering all the rejection, maybe closest to some of the suffering that's going on today in the name of Christ. And I'm not trying to put down Central America or South Africa, but it is being put down for seeing something more. You have a vision of the rule of God that this guy Erlander is always talking about, and Michael too. But I think the people have a taste of it. And it always works from little pieces. It won't work on the big stuff. I mean, it won't be global in the response, but little pieces will work. That's an expression of faith, and I know your colleagues will rub me off. But that's why I had most fun in campus ministry, working with props. Most of my time was spent in their offices.
It is 10 o'clock. And I'm happy to announce that we've solved all the problems.